Hey everyone, welcome into another episode of A Must-Win Game with Maggie Gray. On today's show, Mike Vorkunoff is going to join us. He's an NBA writer for The Athletic. He's been doing reporting on the stunning sale of the Los Angeles Lakers just almost a year after they were sold. This is crazy. Someone flipped an NBA franchise and there's a lot of interesting tentacles to it. So we'll unpack it all with Mike Vorkunoff. But first, a little stock up, stock down. I'm going to start with a stock down, and it's on Ben Johnson, the head coach of the Bears. This does not mean I don't respect Ben Johnson as a coach. I certainly do. What he did with the Bears last year, taking them from a 5-12 team to an 11-6 team, beating the Packers in the wild card round, nearly beating the Rams in the divisional round, actually, if not for maybe a couple questioning coaching decisions that he made, perhaps they would have actually been in the NFC Championship game. So clearly he's getting results in his first season as a coach. And I think he's a great offensive mind. And even as a Bills fan, I'm a little bit scared of why he was so happy to get DJ Moore out of town. And what does that mean for Buffalo's offense? But anyway, that's just my Bills fandom kind of sneaking in. But the stock down goes to a recent article that was written about Ben Johnson and a reporter for The Athletic who spent a day with the Chicago Bears head coach. And here's what he says in the article, and this quote is getting a lot of attention. "You've got 31 other teams coming to training camp saying our goal is to win the Super Bowl," he says. "I want more than that. I want to have the highest scoring offense ever, which happens to be the 2013 Denver Broncos. I know how many points per game they scored, and I want to surpass them. I want shutouts. I want blowouts." I don't know why you would use this example or why you would state this goal out loud. First of all, football ultimate team game. And you might think it's cliched to come in and say the goal is to win the Super Bowl, but to be honest, that's what it should be so everyone feels bought in. You're talking about the offense breaking Denver's record. That's only for the offense. What does the defense get out of this? What, they also want to be a footnote as part of the shutouts here that get mentioned at the end? It's kind of putting a little too much onto the offense, not the defense, not the special teams. And that's what makes football amazing, is that it is a team sport. So I'm actually surprised to hear a coach state a goal like this out loud. Also, can we bring up the obvious? The 2013 Denver Broncos. Okay, they averaged 38 points per game that year. Whoopee for them. They got to the Super Bowl and they got smacked. 2013 Super Bowl. They played the Seattle Seahawks. It was a blowout. That game was over by halftime. I know, I was there. I was covering it for Sports Illustrated. It was a boring Super Bowl because it was not a game. So all that great offense got you absolutely bubkiss in the biggest game. And listen, I'm not one of those people who thinks, oh, if you don't win, the season's a total failure and you can't take anything away from seasons that don't end with Super Bowls. But come on. So it's just kind of an odd goal to be stating to a reporter. Like, you can have your internal metrics that you want to hit, but this seems to me like Ben Johnson has an agenda that he wants to be known and kind of etched in the record books for having the highest scoring offense ever. And it's funny because I'm giving him a stock down also because he's talking out of both sides of his mouth in this article. When he's asked by the reporter about regrets from last year, a big one is how he handled the divisional round against the Rams. It's 25-mile-an-hour winds. It's in Chicago, obviously. Snow, rain, disgusting weather, and he was not prepared for like a grinded-out game. Okay, that's great to have the awareness that you got out-coached in that game because you weren't flexible. Everyone has a game plan, but like you have to be able to be flexible with it when unexpected things happen. So he acknowledges that that was an issue in the biggest game of the season. Yet then coming into the next season, while he supposedly should have learned from that, your stated goal is you want 38 points a game. So are you really worried about winning the game you're in, or are you just worried about hitting this number to get you towards this goal that, to be honest, is, I would say, pretty meaningless to players and fans? So I don't love this from Ben Johnson. And, you know, it's kind of the second time in as many seasons as him being a head coach that he's had some weird thing that he said in the preseason. So last year, it was his introductory press conference where he kind of out of nowhere takes a shot at Packers head coach Matt LaFleur and says how much he would delight in beating LaFleur. It was so awkward that people actually thought the two had a relationship together, like this was some kind of inside joke. Turns out they'd barely met. Now, I guess to be fair to Johnson, they did beat the Packers in the playoffs, so to the victor goes the spoils. But very odd. Felt more like a college coach move than pro. And, you know, I understand the Bears and Packers have a very long rivalry, and maybe that was some red meat to the fan base because the Packers have had this unbelievable winning streak against the Bears, and now that's over. But I just thought it was a little bush league, and he acknowledges this is like an entertainment business, and when he's in the post game and he's giving these riled up speeches and he's taking his shirt off and all these things, he's acknowledging that he is hamming it up for the cameras. But I just get the sense that he's the kind of guy who would not tolerate that from any of his players. Not that he's trying to get all personalities out of the game. Like, I don't think he's a Bill Belichick type guy. But I just can't imagine that if Caleb Williams was doing that kind of stuff, that he would be okay with it. Again, he's winning. No one's going to care about this stuff. But it always just has this little underlying thing of like, what's your goal here, man? Like, what is the main thing? The main thing? Are we trying to win? Are we trying to get famous? Like, what is the goal? We know it's to have the highest scoring offense in league history. So I would say good luck with all of that. Secondly, I want to give a stock. Gosh, I can't do another stock down with the WNBA. It just feels like I'm piling on. But Stephanie White, the head coach of the Indiana Fever, gave a very impassioned press conference the other day. It was about 2 minutes before the Indiana Fever played the New York Liberty. They went on to beat the Liberty. And after this impassioned press conference, Caitlin Clark did say, there's no way we were going to go out and lose. We had to win for our coach. So they were motivated. It obviously meant a lot in that locker room. And what Stephanie White was getting at is, you know, she wasn't going to let online trolls and people who commentate on sports and on their league divide their locker room and divide their league. And obviously, like, the WNBA has become a lightning rod, a punching bag, whatever you want to call it, for all types of political and social justice issues. And I think Stephanie White clearly had reached a breaking point. That was obvious. But her message got a little convoluted, because she was saying, I'm always going to lead with love, and I'm always going to lead with understanding, and I'm going to be the type of leader that embraces everybody. And she punctuated the press conference by saying, and everyone else can go to hell. And I kind of, I get what she was talking about. She's talking about the haters, you know, the people who are just there to poke at the WNBA and to use it for their own gain and their own clicks and all of that. But you can't say show us grace and we lead with love and I lead with love and everyone's welcome here, but everyone else who can go to hell. It's just, again, the message getting mixed up in a really emotional moment while a lot of eyeballs are on the league. And I guess I would just say that I think in times like this, as opposed to meeting a very loud, what I'm sure is very perceived to be a very loud roar of negativity, to meet that also with a roar and loud and kind of yelling, I get the instinct, but I don't think it's effective. And I actually think the more riled up the perceived haters and the haters of the WNBA are, and the pundits and the cable news networks and all that, the more riled up they get, the calmer you are, the less you give them any, like, anything to latch on to. To me, that's winning. Because you're not going to shout everyone down. And I'm sure you want to, and I'm sure even in the moment it probably feels good, but that's going to be very short-lived. And it's kind of like anytime an adult yells, like, do you end up regretting it just a little bit? Like, wow, I probably should have had my emotions a little bit more in check. Ultimately, though, it's the frustration that you see. I get where she was coming from. I just think at that point, meet their anger with either indifference or let it roll off your back. And I know that's really hard, but you are not going to fight back against this mob. And the less you give them, the less oxygen you give them, the better. Because with a press conference like that, no matter if you loved it or hated it, it let the haters know they are in your head. and they're occupying space rent free. Tough needle to thread. I get it. Not easy, but I didn't love it from the coach. I don't think she should be fired. I'm not calling for her job. It's not fireable. It's nothing even close to that, but it just was one of those things where in retrospect, probably would want to handle that a bit different. Okay. That's a little what's going on in the news. Let's get to Mike Vorkunov. We talk about the sale of the Lakers, and I start by asking him, what's the most interesting part of this sale? Was it how it went down or who was involved?
The news drops. It's absolutely stunning. The Lakers are sold, flipped, really. $12.5 billion is the price. And Mike, I think my first question is, what's more surprising to you, how this went down or who the team got sold to?
Yes. look, I think the how, I guess, probably is a little bit more surprising, mostly because, like, this is Mark Walter took over last October at a record-setting price, the $10 billion valuation. Usually when people buy sports teams now, it's not kind of like on a quick buy and flip, right? Especially, again, not at those prices. And so the fact that it's happening less than a year after he bought the team, it's happening obviously against this drumbeat of headlines about him and his companies and a federal investigation. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have that the Lakers sale come out of the ether. That was definitely surprising, right? Like, I think the more headlines we saw about the Mark Walter investigation, the more questions it started to raise. And then he sells the team. At the who, maybe a little bit less surprising. So Bob Iger has reportedly wanted an NBA team for a while. Josh Kushner has owned stakes of two NBA teams, right? As a minority investor, first the Grizzlies, then the Heat. And then he and, you know, those two were trying to buy an NBA expansion team. And that process is underway, bidding not quite there, but like people are doing their, you know, intent. Hey, this is how we'll go. I don't know to compare it to like buying a house, but I guess it's showing up for the open house and letting people know, here's my email. I might be bidding on it later. And so like that part, obviously these two streams kind of converge in this Lakers sale.
Yeah, lots of follow-ups here. First, for people who may not understand, when you say federal investigation into alleged improprieties, not with the Lakers, not with the Dodgers, who Mark Walter also owns, not with Chelsea, the Premier League club he also owns, but an insurance company or multiple insurance companies. Can you flesh that out for us?
I'll do the best I can. It is admittedly like super complex. And so, you know, Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal have done great reporting on this. And it's that the feds are looking into insurance companies that Mark Walter owns and Guggenheim Partners, which he has a stake in and he's the CEO of, and just that they possibly could have like not properly valued things and in their filings to the SEC, and also partially to spur a deal with a UAE sovereign wealth fund that was set to give them $10 billion right ahead of the Lakers sale in 2025. And so those things, Bloomberg reported, to kind of put Mark Walter in a need for cash as he tries to make good on all these things that led to the feds investigating him. And obviously the quickest way to unwind that is to make, you know, almost 25% in less than a year on an NBA team.
Yeah, so Mark Walter he put out a statement, but it was pretty milquetoast, just thanks to the Buss family and blah, blah, blah. But Stan Kasten, who is the president of the Dodgers, he came out yesterday and said this has nothing to do with the investigation, the federal investigation, the sale of the Lakers. Is that beyond belief?
I don't know. I don't know what insight he has into what the feds are investigating and how this affects the entire Mark Walter financial empire, right? He's to your point, president, or I'll just use VIP at the Dodgers, right? Like, what insight does he get into what the rest of Mark Walter's situation is? I can believe that it won't impact the Dodgers necessarily. You know, this is a team that they bought back in 2012, I think. And so maybe it could have predated all these things that the federal government is reportedly looking into. But obviously, you know, Walter has kind of a sports empire, or at least had until earlier this week with the Dodgers and the Lakers and the Sparks too, which is another team he owns.
Of course, the WNBA team that is not a part of this deal. Okay, so while we're talking about characters kind of in this story, I don't know how many sports fans really knew Josh Kushner, even as a minority owner of Memphis and then of the Miami Heat, but we got to know him because of the story about FIFA and the World Cup. And Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, was all poised to sell off part of the World Cup to private equity, and it was going to be Josh Kushner. The backlash was so loud and so swift that they called the deal off. So, like, how does that play into the story? Because it's almost like, all right, well, we were going to buy the World Cup or a $4.2 billion stake in the World Cup. All right, let's just pivot. We'll buy the Lakers.
Yeah, this Lakers sale is really interesting because now the more we talk about it, it seems like it's like a Venn diagram of like five different circles. And they're all kind of converging, you know, atop the Staples Center. I'm going to call it the Staples Center. But, you know, like, so yeah. So on top of all the other stuff we talked about, you're right. You know, Josh Kushner through Thrive Capital, which is his venture capital fund, you know, they were set to be the lead investors in investing in, I believe, roughly 20% of what FIFA was going to do, like a financial commercial spin out of all the, you know, the properties that they own. And that was going to be worth about $4.2 billion. And that was met with such visceral reaction when it went public, such visceral distaste and anger from so many parts of the soccer world that they just like killed it, right? And now Gianni Infantino is fighting for his job. You see like UEFA and other soccer federations, including the one the US is in, saying like, we don't want you as president. This is, you know, like a catastrophe. And so, you know, this comes right after the Lakers sale comes right after, you know, that deal dies. And so theoretically Thrive might have some extra money sitting around in addition to the money that they allocated to kind of bid on an NBA expansion team. And, you know, a Vegas expansion team roughly was going to go in the neighborhood of $8 to $10 billion. It seemed like, and they were going to be the lead investors in a $4.2 billion-ish investment round, and 8 plus 4.2 kind of gets us to about 12 and a half. Using my loose non-reporting math, you know, it does seem like a convergence of things all comes together here.
All right. So obviously people are now going to know Kushner for another reason, because he's got a pretty famous last name, because his brother is married to Ivanka Trump. And there are some out there, and I'm curious how much credence you give what is being called a conspiracy theory, or as you said, the sort of Venn diagram of people who are involved in this story. A cynic may look at this and say, Mark Walter is being investigated by the FBI, by the feds. He needs some leniency here, or needs a favor. So maybe I'll, I don't know, sell the Lakers to someone who is at least somewhat in President Trump's orbit. Is this worth the cynicism? Is there anything here?
I mean, look, I'm never one to kill a good conspiracy theory, but as a reporter, I kind of have to live in the world of facts. And at least right now, there is nothing tangible kind of like standing that up. You know, obviously Josh Kushner and Jared Kushner are brothers, they're siblings. I don't think that we've seen Josh Kushner kind of get involved, let's say in that side of the family to this point. But yeah, I mean, we've seen what's happened during the administration, so I understand why people are making that leap. I just don't know if there's anything there right now to kind of stand that up, and it might just be a conspiracy theory, because I think the most, you know, Occam's razor, the most logical thing is that Mark Walter is under investigation and, you know, in need of money to kind of like deal with that. And honestly, spinning off like, you know, the thing that you just bought most recently, that is a very high value as a quick way to get the cash that you need, makes a lot of sense. And it seems like Bloomberg reported too that he's you know, talked to other investors about, you know, other deals that might help him get the capital that he's looking for.
Yeah, which is funny though, because the Dodgers are so steadfast that nothing is going to happen. Meanwhile, the guy is selling off very valuable pieces of his portfolio. So, okay, the basketball of it all. You know, just because Mark Walter was there for a short amount of time doesn't mean that he didn't make some changes. There was a new president who came in. Rob Pelinka is still there. We saw, obviously, their most important player, Luka Doncic, sent out a social media post of support. I don't know what else he's going to do or say. you know, they traded some major draft capital for Walker Kessler. Like, there have been some decisions that have definitely been made under Mark Walter's watch. Does this impact the Lakers in a basketball way? If so, how?
I mean, that's a great question. And I think, I'm sure a lot of people around the NBA are wondering that, because like the whole premise of Mark Walter taking over the Lakers was that he was going to Dodgersify the Lakers, right? Like the Dodgers under the Buss family for so long were super successful, but also just like really a mom and pop type of organization. It was small front. Like, which is weird, right? Like with the Los Angeles team is the one with the small front office that's not known for, you know, these gigantic coaching staffs and personnel, but it's really what they were. Like Jeannie Buss ran that thing tight with her and, you know, Linda Rambis and Rob Pelinka and, you know, Kurt Rambis had a voice there. And they were hiring new assistant GMs. They were supposed to build out the front office. You know, Farhan Zaidi, who's the former Giants San Francisco Giants general manager, and Andrew Friedman were, you know, involved in like understanding what was going on and helping do that build out, make them more analytical and more empirical, and all these things that the Dodgers have had success with. You know, like you saw it on the Sparks too. They hired a bunch of, you know, they hired an assistant GM and, you know, other execs too to make it more analytics based. So like, what happens with all of that, right? Like, what happens to that build out? Do Iger and Kushner want to continue that process? We don't know anything about the way that they want to run an NBA team. And I think it's an important question. Like, I think modernizing the Lakers would have really helped them, but do they want to do that? Do they want to invest in that? And we really don't know yet. And I think that's going to be an important question. Like, Rob Pelinka is on his third owner in a year. Will this one want to continue to keep him in that job? Like anytime, you know, it's not that crazy to see a new owner take over and want his own person, right? Running basketball ops. And I don't think Luka Doncic's going anywhere. It's a very nice statement he made. I don't think he has to worry about anything really, but everyone else is probably wondering what's going to happen going forward.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, Jeannie Buss is supposedly supposed to stay on as the governor for the next few years. And, I believe Bob Iger said, if things change, they change. So that's a nice way of saying, pack up your office and don't let the door hit you. We saw this happen with the Dallas Mavericks too. And even in Boston, when a new owner comes in or when they have the majority, they want the big stage. They want to be there getting all the glory.
I mean, it's kind of logical, right? If I'm paying, you know, it's a $12.5 billion valuation, but if you're paying like $7 billion in cash, like I kind of want to run the thing, you know, I don't want someone else to run the thing. So yeah, that was one of those not great Bob kind of moments.
A couple more for you. And again, thanks for doing this. So the other stunning thing about the sale was how quickly this went down. So obviously like the way that Ramona Shelburne, who broke the story, made it seem like that Bob Iger and Josh Kushner were sitting around one day like, I wonder who would want to sell their team, and didn't think of anyone else except for the Lakers, and made a cold call on a Sunday. And then by Wednesday, the team was sold. Did Adam Silver not have to get involved anywhere here? Do you think Adam Silver maybe secretly had a hand in this because Bob Iger has been so open about the fact that he does want to buy a team? Like, how does this happen in 72 hours, basically?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question too. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you saw Bob Iger talk to the California Post on Wednesday, and he said like, oh, someone let him know that Mark Walter might be willing to sell the Lakers. So it's kind of me thinking, who is that someone
like on the
there,
golf
right?
Course? Yeah, probably Adam Silver, I'm thinking.
Well, I mean, listen, I don't know where billionaires golf. It might actually literally be possible that they're in the same golf course. But yeah, like, you know, Adam Silver runs the NBA, great friend of Bob Iger. I'm not saying it's him, but it did kind of, you know, raise your alarm bells. Like, okay, who's the one who kind of tipped them off? And this came together quickly. And I think we'll learn more in the days and weeks to come of like how this all went down.
I actually was just reminded of a headline from many years ago. Do you remember when Adam Silver was floated as a possible candidate to take over Disney?
Yeah. I do. Yes, I asked him about it. Yeah, he didn't seem happy when I brought that up.
I'm sure he was not happy about this. Okay, last one for you. And it's more about the Vegas side of this, which is the LeBron James of it all. You know, LeBron has said that he wants to own a franchise. I kind of always thought LeBron might have been circling Las Vegas. Now there's this sort of, I don't know, is there an opening here for a billionaire to come in and kind of stake their claim on this Vegas project now that Iger and Kushner are in LA with the Lakers?
I think, you know, it's going to be a very expensive opening. There's still a lot of, you know, there's at least a handful that we know of interested parties. We've got Bill Foley, who owns the Las Vegas Knights. He's building a group together. There's a group kind of like with Jerry Colangelo as a big name figurehead there, but they say they've raised $8 billion already and could raise up to 13. Someone from the Walton family is reportedly interested. Magic Johnson has a group. So there's others that we don't know about. Certainly, it's going to cost a lot of money. And LeBron James is a partner in Fenway Sports Group, which is another private equity firm that kind of buys and sells all sports teams. But they said that they're out. LeBron, I think, publicly said he's out as well, unless he's, you know, changes course and latches on to someone else. But it might just be too expensive for them. But I think there's, you know, the way that Adam Silver talked at his Board of Governors press conference last month, it made it seem like a team was coming to Vegas. Like, that's probably the most optimistic he's been and the most forward he's been about that happening. And so really, I'm kind of interested in how much it could cost, because it could be a lot. Like, that could hit $10 billion as well, potentially, with that kind of bidding going on.
I lied. Got to ask you another one, because you've spent a lot. Unless there's something I haven't asked you about the Lakers sale that you think that I should have asked.
No, I mean, I think that's it. It's such an interesting thing. Like, you never see a team like the Lakers get sold, and then they get sold twice in a year, and both times set a new record. Like, that's wild.
I know. I was thinking it's kind of like the Pittsburgh Steelers, who have had, you know, three coaches, in their entire history. And it's like, if Mike McCarthy got fired next year, it's like, and all of a sudden they just like start cycling a team that was so known for one thing. And then all of a sudden it just becomes like a revolving door, and how odd that is to reconcile. You've been spending a lot of time in Brooklyn courtrooms listening to plea deals. Where are we right now with the federal probe into the gambling ring that shocked sports fans? I mean, Terry Rozier was a massive name. Chauncey Billups, Damon Jones. I mean, this was the big gambling scandal maybe of our time.
Yeah, I mean, and then you throw in Malik Beasley and Ed Davis, two other NBA players, were arrested and indicted this summer. I've spent a lot of time in the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse. I'm not saying that as a humble brag. I'm literally just saying it's been too much time. But in the, it's two cases, right? The one where Terry Rozier is a defendant is down to four defendants. It looks like they're set to go to trial. That trial is scheduled for February 8th. Terry Rozier, at least his lawyer said he's going to go to trial. One of his co-defendants actually just got his bond revoked and was put into handcuffs and put into custody earlier this week, because the judge decided that he was intimidating witnesses and trying to communicate with co-defendants, which you cannot do. And so they're going to go to trial. Damon Jones pleaded guilty. He's set to be sentenced sometime next year, I believe. And in the rigged poker game case, where Chauncey Billups is a defendant, about half of the people who were indicted have pleaded guilty already. And they also seem like they're going to go to trial. Chauncey Billups, sorry, is going to go to trial. And that's for the end of November. And so we're just all kind of waiting on that and to see what trial looks like. And, if you go to trial, there will be witnesses and testimony and evidence. And I'm sure that will be fascinating to see what we learn. And, you know, I think the one thing that we learned during all of this is just like, you know, the big question I've had really is like, okay, these are NBA players, these are NBA coaches. How did they get into a situation where sports gamblers, you know, allegedly criminal sports gamblers were in a place where they could reach them and contact them and communicate with either them or the people around them? And so those trials, if they get there, if they go to trials, they say they will, like, it really might open some doors for us in terms of how things really work in the NBA.
It's fascinating. And also just the psychology behind what would make somebody, and these are all allegations, obviously everyone's going to have their day in court, but if you're Terry Rozier, you're making millions of dollars. Why would you do this for $100,000? You know, it doesn't compute. Also just word of the wise, if you are facing like jail time for these kinds of crimes, don't put a rat emoji on somebody's Instagram post, because that will be interpreted in a threatening manner. And I learned that from your article, so thank you.
Yes, the judge was not having it when the lawyer for one of the defendants tried to tell him it was just a rat cartoon. So also don't try that excuse either. Don't just say it was a rat cartoon if you do post a rat emoji.
You know, as someone who has to think on their feet a lot doing live TV and live radio, I kind of respect it, but it's such BS that I can understand also why the judge got very mad about that. Mike, thanks so much for your great reporting. This has been fun, and I'd love to catch up again when we have more famous people in court.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll talk in the fall.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of A Must-Win Game. I'll be back on Monday morning with a brand new podcast for you. In the meantime, if you are watching on YouTube, or even if you're not, could you please, please hit the subscribe button? Oh my gosh, I'm begging. Literally, it's a very small thing. It does a ton for me. You can also follow me on social media at Maggie Gray on Twitter, at Maggie Talk Sports on Instagram, and at A Must Win Game on YouTube. Later.